This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Crossing the Chasm, Marketing and Selling Disruptive Products to Mainstream Customers by Jeffrey A. Moore. Read by Mike Chamberlain. Preface to the Revised Edition. Obi-Wan Kenobi, says Sir Alec Guinness in the original Star Wars movie. Now there's a name I haven't heard for a long, long time. The same might well be said of a number of the companies that served as examples in the original edition of Crossing the Chasm. Reading through its index brings to mind the medieval lament, "Where are the snows of yesteryear?" Where indeed are Aldous, Apollo, Ashton Tate, Ask, Burroughs, Businessland, and the Bite Shop? Where are Wang, Waytech, and Zilog? Oh, lost and by the wind-grieved ghosts, come back again! But we should not despair. In high tech, the good news is that, although we lose our companies with alarming frequency, we keep the people along with the ideas, and so the industry as a whole goes forward vibrantly, even as the names on our paychecks slide into another seamlessly. Okay, as seamlessly as our systems interoperate, which as marketing claims is, well, that's another matter. Crossing the Chasm was written in 1990 and published in 1991. Originally forecast to sell 5,000 copies, it has, over a 7-year period in the market, sold more than 175,000. In high-tech marketing, we call this an upside miss. The appeal of the book, I believe, is that it puts a vocabulary to a market development problem that has given untold grief to any number of high-tech enterprises. Seeing the problem externalized in print has a sort of redemptive effect on people who have fallen prey to it in the past. It wasn't all my fault. Moreover, like a good book on golf, its prescriptions give great hope that just by making this or that minor adjustment, perfect results are bound to follow. This time, we'll make it work. And so any number of people cheerfully have told me that the book has become the Bible in their company. So much for the spiritual health of our generation. In editing this revised edition, I have tried to touch as little as possible the logic of the original. This is harder than you might think, because over the past decade, my views have changed. All right, I've become older, and I have an inveterate tendency to meddle, as any number of my clients and colleagues will testify. The problem is, when you meddle, you get in deeper and deeper, until God knows what you have. But it wasn't what you started with. I have plenty enough opportunity to do that with future books, and I have enough respect for this one to try to stand off a bit. That being said, I did make a few significant exceptions. I eliminated the section on using thematic niches as a legitimate tactic for crossing the chasm. It turns out instead they were a placeholder for the market tactics used during emerging hypergrowth market, a challenge covered in a subsequent book, Inside the Tornado. Also, I have substituted a revised scenario process for the original to incorporate improvements that have evolved over the past several years of consulting at the Chasm Group. Elsewhere, I took a slightly new angle on creating the competition, and, when it came to the section on distribution, I have done my best to incorporate the emerging influence of the Internet. But the overwhelming bulk of the changes in this new edition, representing about a third of total text, Simply swap out the original examples from the 1980s with new ones from the 1990s. Surprisingly, in the majority of cases, this swap works very well. But in other cases, there's been a little force-fitting, and I want to beg your indulgence up front. The world has changed. The high-tech community is now crossing the chasm intentionally rather than unintentionally. And there are now competitors who have read the same book and create plans to block chasm crossing. The basic forces don't change, but the tactics have become more complicated. Moreover, we are seeing a new effect which was just barely visible in the prior decade. The piggybacking of one company's offer on another to skip the chasm entirely and jump straight into hypergrowth. In the 1980s, Lotus piggybacked on VisiCalc to accomplish this feat in the spreadsheet category. In the 1990s, Microsoft has done the same thing to Netscape in browsers. The key insight here is that we should always be tracking the evolution of a technology, rather than a given company's product line. It's the technology adaption life cycle, after all. Thus, it is spreadsheets, not VisiCalc, Lotus, or Excel, that is the adoption category. Just as it is browsers, not Navigator or Explorer. In the early days, products and categories were synonymous, because technologies were on their first cycles. But today, we have multiple decades of invention to build on, and a new offer is no longer quite as new or unprecedented as it used to be. The marketplace is therefore able to absorb this not-quite-so-new technology in gulps, for a while letting one company come to the fore, but substituting another should the first company stumble. Finally, let me close by noting technological changes do not live in isolation, but rather come under the influence of changes in surrounding technologies as well. In the early 90s, it was the sea change to graphical user interfaces and client-server topologies that created the primary context. As we come to the close of the century, it is the complete shift of communications infrastructure to the Internet. These major technology shifts create huge sine waves of change that interact with the smaller sine waves of more local technology shifts, occasionally synthesizing harmonically, more frequently playing out some discordant mix that has customers growling and investors howling. Navigating in such uncharted waters requires beacons that can be seen above the waves, and that is what models in general, and the chasm models in particular, are for. Models are like constellations. They are not intended to change in themselves, but their value is in giving perspective on a highly changing world. The chasm model represents a pattern in market development that is based on the tendency of pragmatic people to adopt new technology when they see other people like them doing the same. This causes them to hang together as a group, and the group's initial reaction, like teenagers at a junior high dance, is to hesitate and watch. This is the chasm effect. The tendency is very deep-rooted, and so the pattern is very persistent. As a result, marketers can predict its appearance and build strategies to cope with it. And it is the purpose of this book to help in that process. But fixing your position relative to the North Star does not keep water out of the boat. As the French proverb says, God loves a sailor, but he has to row for himself. And in that act of rowing, the work is huge and the risks high. And every reader of this book, who is also a practitioner of high-tech market development, has my deepest respect. With that thought in mind, let me turn you over now to Regis McKenna, author of the original foreword back in 1991. Foreword. With an ever-changing society, marketing represents the ongoing effort to keep the means of production, our products and services, in touch with evolving social and personal conditions. That keeping in touch has become our greatest challenge. In an era when the pace of change was slower, the variety of products and services fewer, the channels of communication and distribution less pervasive, and the consumer less sophisticated, marketing could enjoy prolonged periods of relative stability, reaping profits from holding the customer constant and optimizing the other variables. That is no longer the case. We live in an age of choice. We are continually bombarded with purchasing alternatives in every aspect of our lives. This, in turn, has led us to develop an increasingly sophisticated set of defenses, so that any company seeking to establish a brand loyalty in us is going to be hard-pressed to succeed. We demand more and more from our purchases and our suppliers, leading to increasingly fragmented markets served by products that can be customized by design, programmability, service, or variety. There is a wonderful analogy to all this in the world of high technology. Behind the astounding proliferation of electronic systems infiltrating our entertainment centers, our phones, our cares, and our kitchens, lies a technology called application-specific integrated circuits, or ASICs. These are tiny microprocessors that are producible in high volume up to the last layer, which is then designed by the customers to add the final veneer of personality needed for their specific product. ASICs embody many of the fundamental elements of modern marketing. Radical customizability overlaid onto a constant and reliable foundation. Dramatically shortened times to market. Relatively small production runs. And an intense focus on customer service. They exemplify the remaking of our means of production to accommodate our changing social and personal needs. As uplifting as all of this sounds in theory, in practice, it represents a great challenge, not only to our economic institutions, but to the human spirit itself. We may celebrate change and growth, but that does not make either one the less demanding or painful. Our emerging and evolving markets are demanding continual adaptation and renewal, not only in times of difficulty, but on the heels of our greatest successes as well. Which of us would not prefer a little more time to savor that success, to reap a little longer what we cannot help but feel are our just rewards? It is only natural to cling to the past, when the past represents so much of what we have strived to achieve. This is the key to crossing the chasm. The chasm represents the gulf between two distinct marketplaces for technology products. The first, an early market dominated by early adopters and insiders who are quick to appreciate the nature and benefits of the new development. And the second, a mainstream market representing the rest of us. People who want the benefits of new technology, but who do not want to experience it in all its gory details. The transition between these two markets is anything but smooth. Indeed, what Jeff Moore has brought into focus is that at the time when one has just achieved great initial success in launching a new technology product, creating what he calls early market wins, one must undertake an immense effort and radical transformation to make the transition into serving the mainstream market. This transition involves sloughing off familiar entrepreneurial marketing habits and taking up new ones that at first feel strangely counterintuitive. It is a demanding time at best, and I will leave the diagnosis of its ailments and the prescription of its remedies to the insightful chapters that follow. If we step back from this chasm problem, we can see it as an instance of the larger problem of how the marketplace can cope with change in general. For both the customer and the vendor, continually changing products and services challenge their institution's ability to absorb and make use of the new elements. What can marketing do to buffer these shocks? Fundamentally, marketing must refocus away from selling product and toward creating relationship. Relationship buffers the shock of change. To be sure, the specific product or service provided remains the fundamental basis for economic exchange, but it must not be treated as the main event. There is simply too much change in this domain for anyone to tolerate over the long haul. Instead, we must direct our attention toward creating and maintaining an ongoing customer relationship, so that as things change and stir in our immediate field of activity, we can look up over the smoke and dust and see an abiding partner, willing to cooperate and adjust with us as we take on our day-to-day challenges. Marketing's first deliverable is that partnership. This is what we mean when we talk about owning a market. Customers do not like to be owned, if that implies lack of choice or freedom. The open systems movement in high tech is a clear example of that. But they do like to be owned, if what that means is a vendor taking ongoing responsibility for the success of their joint ventures. Ownership, in this sense, means abiding commitment and a strong sense of mutuality in the development of the marketplace. When customers encounter this kind of ownership, they tend to become fanatically loyal to their supplier, which in turn builds a stable economic base for profitability and growth. How can marketing foster such relationships? That question has driven the development of Regis McKenna Inc. since its inception. We began in the 1970s in our work with Intel and Apple, where we tried to set a new tone around the adoption of technology products to capture the imagination of a marketplace whose attentions were directed elsewhere. Working with Intel, Apple, Genentech, and many other new technology companies, it became clear that traditional marketing approaches would not work. Business schools in America were educating their students to the ways of consumer marketing, and these graduates assumed that marketing was generic. Advertising and brand awareness became synonymous with marketing. In the 1980s, intense competition, even within small niches, created a new environment. With everyone competing for the customer's attention, the customer became king and demanded more substance than image. Advertising, as a medium of communication, could not sustain the kind of relationship that was needed for ongoing success. Two reasons in particular stood out. First, as Vance Packard in The Hidden Persuaders and others educated the American populace to the manipulativeness of advertising, its credibility as a means of communication deteriorated. This was an extremely serious loss when it came to high-tech purchase decisions because of what IBM used to call the FUD factor, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that can plague decision-makers when confronted with such an unfamiliar set of products and services. Just when they most want to trust in the communication process, they are confronted with an ad that they believe may be leading them astray. The second problem with advertising is that it is a one-way mechanism of communication. As the emphasis shifts more and more from selling product to creating relationship, the demand for a two-way means of communication increases. Companies do not get it right the first time. To pick two current market-leading examples, the first Macintosh and the first release of Windows simply were not right. Both needed major overhauls before they could become the runaway successes they represent today. This was only possible by Apple and Microsoft keeping in close touch with their customers and the other participants that make up the PC marketplace. The standard we tried to set at RMI was one of education, not promotion. The goal being to communicate rather than to manipulate. The mechanism being dialogue, not monologue. The fundamental requirement for the ongoing interoperability needed to sustain high tech is accurate and honest exchange of information. Your partners need it, your distribution channel needs it and must support it, and your customers demand it. People in the 1990s simply will not put up with non-credible channels of communication. They will take their business elsewhere. At RMI, we call the building of market relationships, market relations. The fundamental basis of market relations is to build and manage relationships with all the members that make up a high-tech marketplace, not just the most visible ones. In particular, it means setting up formal and informal communications, not only with customers, press, and analysts, but also with hardware and software partners, distributors, dealers, VARs, systems and integrators, user groups, vertically oriented industry organizations, universities, standards bodies, and international partners. It means improving not only your external communications, but also your internal exchange of information among the sales force, the product managers, strategic planners, customer service and support, engineering, manufacturing, and finance. To facilitate such relationships implies a whole new kind of expertise from a consulting organization. In addition to maintaining its communications disciplines, it must also provide experienced counsel and leadership in making fundamental marketing decisions. Market entry, market segmentation, competitive analysis, positioning, distribution, pricing. All these are issues with which a successful marketing effort must come to grips. And so we again remade ourselves, adding to market relations a second practice, high-tech marketing consulting. Today, our practices of marketing consulting and market relations together are tackling the fundamental challenge of the 1990s, helping multiple players in the marketplace build what we call whole product solutions to market needs. Whole products represent completely configured solutions. Today, unlike the early 1980s, no single vendor, not even an IBM, can unilaterally provide the whole products needed. A new level of cooperation and communication must be defined and implemented so that companies, not just products, can interoperate to create these solutions. Crossing the Chasm reflects much of this emphasis. Moore is a senior member of the RMI staff and has become an integral contributor to the development of our practice. An ex-professor and teacher by trade, he does not shrink from taking the stage to evangelize a new agenda. Part of that agenda is to make original contributions to the marketing discipline. And as you will see in the coming chapters, Jeff has done just that. At the same time, as he himself is quick to acknowledge, his colleagues and his clients have made immense contributions as well. And he is to be commended for his efforts in integrating these components into this work. Finally, I would just like to say that this work is going to make you think. And the best way to prepare yourself for the fast-paced, ever-changing competitive world of marketing is to prepare yourself to think. This book adds the dimension of creative thinking as a prelude to action. It will change the way you think about marketing. It will change the way you think about market relationships. Regis McKenna. Part 1. Discovering the Chasm. Introduction. If Bill Gates can be a billionaire. There is a line from a song in the musical A Chorus Line. If Troy Donahue can be a movie star, then I can be a movie star. Every year, one imagines hearing a version of this line reprised in high-tech startups across the country. If Bill Gates can be a billionaire. For indeed, the great thing about high-tech is that, despite numerous disappointments, it still holds out the siren's lure of a legitimate, get-rich-quick opportunity. But let us set our sights a little more modestly. Let us say, if in the 1980s, two guys, each named Mike Brown, one from Portland, Oregon, and the other from Lenexa, Kansas, can in 10 years found two companies no one has ever heard of, Central Point Software and Innovative Software, and bring to market two software products that have hardly become household names, PC Tools Deluxe and Smartware, and still be able to cash out in seven figures? And by God, we should be able to, too. This is the great lure. And yet, as even the Bible has warned us, while many are called, few are chosen. Every year, millions of dollars, not to mention countless work hours of our nation's best technical talent, are lost in failed attempts to join this kingdom of the elect. And oh, what wailing then, what gnashing of teeth. Why me? Cries out the unsuccessful entrepreneur, or rather, why not me? Why not us? Chorus his equally unsuccessful investors. Look at our product. Is it not as good, nay, better, than the product that beat us out? How can you say that Oracle is better than Sybase? Microsoft Word is better than WordPerfect. Cisco's routers are better than Bay Networks. Or that Pentium is better than the PowerPC. How indeed? For in fact, feature for feature, the less successful product is often arguably superior. Not content to slink off the stage without some revenge, this sullen and resentful crew casts about among themselves to find a scapegoat. And whom do they light upon? With unfailing consistency and unerring accuracy, all fingers point to the Vice President of Marketing. It is marketing's fault. Oracle outmarketed Sybase. Microsoft outmarketed WordPerfect. Cisco outmarketed Bay. Intel outmarketed Motorola. Now we too have been outmarketed. Firing is too good for this monster. Hang him! While this sort of thing takes its toll on the marketing profession, there is more at stake in these failures than a bumpy executive career path. When a high-tech venture fails, everyone goes down with the ship. Not only the investors, but also the engineers, the manufacturers, the president, and the receptionist. All those extra hours worked in hopes of cashing in on an equity option, all gone. Worse still, because there is no clear reason why one venture succeeds and the next one fails, the sources of capital to fund new products and companies become increasingly wary of investing. Interest rates go up, and the willingness to entertain venture risks goes down. Wall Street has long been at wit's end when it comes to high-tech stocks. Despite the efforts of some of its best analysts, these stocks are traditionally undervalued and exceedingly volatile. It is not uncommon for a high-tech company to announce even a modest shortfall in its quarterly projections and incur a 20 to 30% devaluation in stock price on the following day of trading. There is an even more serious ramification. High-tech inventiveness and marketing expertise are two cornerstones of the U.S. strategy for global competitiveness. We will never have the lowest cost of labor or raw materials, so we must continue to exploit advantages further down the value chain. If we cannot at least learn to predictably and successfully bring high-tech products to market, our counterattack will falter, placing our entire standard of living in jeopardy. With so much at stake, the erratic results of high-tech marketing are particularly frustrating, especially in a society where other forms of marketing appear to be so well under control. Elsewhere, in cars or TVs or microwaves, we may see ourselves being out-manufactured, but not out-marketed. Indeed, even after we have lost an entire category of goods to offshore competition, we remain the experts in marketing these goods to U.S. consumers. Why haven't we been able to apply these same skills to high tech? And what is it going to take for us to finally get it right? It is the purpose of this book to answer these two questions in considerable detail. But the short answer is as follows. Our current model for how to develop a high-tech market is almost, but not quite, right. As a result, our marketing ventures, despite normally promising starts, drift off course in puzzling ways, eventually causing unexpected and unnerving gaps in sales revenues, and sooner or later leading management to undertake some desperate remedy. Occasionally, these remedies work out, and the result is a high-tech marketing success. Of course, when these are written up in retrospect, what was learned in hindsight is not infrequently portrayed as foresight, with the result that no one sees how perilously close to the edge the enterprise veered. More often, however, the remedies either flat-out fail, and a product or a company goes belly up, or they progress after a fashion to some kind of limp but breathing half-life, in which the company has long since abandoned its dreams of success and contents itself with once again making payroll. None of this is necessary. We have enough high-tech marketing history now to see where our model has gone wrong and how to fix it. To be specific, the point of greatest peril in the development of a high-tech market lies in making the transition from an early market dominated by a few visionary customers to a mainstream market dominated by a large block of customers who are predominantly pragmatists in orientation. The gap between these two markets, heretofore ignored, is in fact so significant as to warrant being called a chasm. And crossing this chasm must be the primary focus of any long-term high-tech marketing plan. A successful crossing is how high-tech fortunes are made. Failure in the attempt is how they are lost. For the past decade and more, I, along with my colleagues at the Chasm Group, have watched countless companies struggle to maintain their footing during this difficult period. It is an extremely difficult transition, for reasons that will be summarized in the opening chapters of the book. The good news is that there are reliable guiding principles. The material in this book was born of hundreds of consulting engagements focused on bringing products and companies into profitable and sustainable mainstream markets. The models presented here have been tested again and again and have been found effective. The chasm, in sum, can be crossed. Like a hermit crab that has outgrown its shell, the company crossing the chasm must scurry to find its new home. Until it does, it will be prey to all kinds of predators. This urgency means that everyone in the company, not just the marketing and salespeople, must focus all their efforts on this one end until it is accomplished. Chapters 3 through 7 set forth the principles necessary to guide high-tech ventures during this period of great risk. This section focuses on marketing, because that is where the leadership must come from. But I ultimately argue in the conclusion that leaving the chasm behind requires significant changes throughout the high-tech enterprise. The book closes, therefore, with a call for new strategies in the areas of finance, organizational development, and R&D. This book is unabashedly about and for marketing within high-tech enterprises. But high-tech can be viewed as a microcosm of larger industrial trends. In particular, the relationship between an early market and a mainstream market is not unlike the relationship between a fad and a trend. Marketing has long known how to exploit fads and how to develop trends. The problem, since these techniques are antithetical to each other, is that you need to decide which one, fad or trend, you are dealing with before you start. It would be much better if you could start with a fad, exploit it for all it was worth, and then turn it into a trend. That may seem like a miracle, but that is in essence what high-tech marketing is all about. Every truly innovative high-tech product starts out as a fad, something with no known market value or purpose, but with great properties that generate a lot of enthusiasm within an in-crowd. That's the early market. Then comes a period during which the rest of the world watches to see if anything can be made of this. That is the chasm. If, in fact, something does come out of it, if a value proposition is discovered that can predictably be delivered to a targetable set of customers at a reasonable price, then a new mainstream market forms, typically with a rapidity that allows its initial leaders to become very, very successful. The key in all this is crossing the chasm, making that mainstream market emerge. This is a do-or-die proposition for high-tech enterprises. Hence, it is logical that they be the crucible in which chasm theory is formed. But the principles can be generalized to other forms of marketing. So for the general reader who can bear with all the high-tech examples in this book, useful lessons may be learned. One of the most important lessons about crossing the chasm is that the task ultimately requires achieving an unusual degree of company unity during the crossing period. This is a time when one should forego the quest for eccentric marketing genius in favor of achieving an informed consensus among mere mortals. It is a time not for dashing and expensive gestures, but rather for careful plans and cautiously rationed resources. A time not to gamble all on some brilliant coup, but rather to focus everyone on making as few mistakes as possible. One of the functions of this book, therefore, and perhaps its most important one, is to open up the logic of marketing decision-making during this period, so that everyone on the management team can participate in the marketing process. If prudence rather than brilliance is to be our guiding principle, then many heads are better than one. If marketing is going to be the driving force, and most organizations insist this is their goal, then its principles must be accessible to all the players, and not, as is sometimes the case, be reserved to an elect few who have managed to penetrate its mysteries. Crossing the chasm, therefore, is written for the entire high-tech community, for everyone who is a stakeholder in the venture, engineers as well as marketeers, and financiers as well. All must come to a common accord if the chasm is to be safely negotiated. And with that thought in mind, let us turn to Chapter 1. 1. High-tech marketing illusion. As the revised edition of this book is being written, it is 1998, and for this time, we have seen a commercial release of the electric car. General Motors makes one, and Ford and Chrysler are sure to follow. Let's assume the cars work like any other, except they are quieter and better for the environment. Now the question is, when are you going to buy one? The technology adoption life cycle. Your answer to the preceding question will tell a lot about how you relate to the technology adoption life cycle, a model for understanding the acceptance of new products. If your answer is, not until hell freezes over, you are probably a very late adopter of technology, what we call in the model a laggard. If your answer is, When I have seen electric cars prove themselves, and when there are enough service stations on the road, you might be a middle-of-the-road adopter, or in the model, the early majority. If you say, not until most people have made the switch, and it becomes really inconvenient to drive a gasoline car, you are probably more of a follower, a member of the late majority. If, on the other hand, you want to be the first one on your block with an electric car, you are apt to be an innovator or an early adopter. In a moment, we are going to take a look at these labels in greater detail. But first, we need to understand their significance. It turns out our attitude toward technology adoption becomes significant, at least in a marketing sense, anytime we are introduced to products that require us to change our current mode of behavior, or to modify other products and services we rely on. In academic terms, such change-sensitive products are called discontinuous innovations. The contrasting term, continuous innovations, refers to the normal upgrading of products that does not require us to change behavior. For example, when Crest promises you whiter teeth, that is a continuous innovation. You still are brushing the same teeth in the same way with the same toothbrush. When Ford's new Taurus promises better mileage, when Dell's latest computer promises faster processing times and more storage space, or when Sony promises sharper and brighter TV pictures, these are all continuous innovations. As a consumer, you don't have to change your ways in order to take advantage of these improvements. On the other hand, if the Sony were a high-definition TV, it would be incompatible with today's broadcasting standards, which would require you to seek out special sources of programming. This would be a discontinuous innovation, because you would have to change your normal TV viewing behavior. Similarly, if the new Dell computer were to come with a B operating system, it would be incompatible with today's software base. Again, you would be required to seek out a whole new set of software, thereby classifying this too as a discontinuous innovation. Or if the new Ford car, as we just noted, required electricity instead of gasoline, or if the new toothpaste were a mouthwash that did not use a toothbrush, then once again you would have a product incompatible with your current infrastructure of supporting components. In all these cases, the innovation demands significant changes by not only the consumer, but also the infrastructure. That is how and why such innovations come to be called discontinuous. Between continuous and discontinuous lies a spectrum of demands for change. TV dinners, unlike microwave dinners, did not require the purchase of a new oven, but they did require the purchase of more freezer space. Color TV programming did not, like VCRs, require investing in and mastering a new technology. But they did require buying a new TV and learning more about tuning and antennas than many of us wanted to learn. The special washing instructions for certain fabrics, the special street lanes reserved for bicycle riders, the special dialing instructions for calling overseas all represent some new level of demand on the consumer to absorb a change in behavior. Sooner or later, all businesses must make these demands. And so it is that all businesses can profit by lessons from high-tech industries. Whereas other industries introduce discontinuous innovations only occasionally and with much trepidation, high-tech enterprises do so routinely and as confidently as a born-again Christian holding four aces. From their inception, therefore, high-tech industries needed a marketing model that coped effectively with this type of product introduction. Thus, the technology adoption life cycle became central to the entire sector's approach to marketing. People are usually amused to learn that the original research that gave rise to this model was done on the adoption of new strains of seed potatoes among American farmers. Despite these agrarian roots, however, the model has thoroughly transplanted itself into the soil of Silicon Valley. The model describes the market penetration of any new technology product in terms of a progression in the types of consumers it attracts throughout its useful life. As you can see from the figure on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, we have a bell curve. The divisions in the curve are roughly equivalent to where standard deviations would fall. That is, the early majority and the late majority fall within one standard deviation of the mean, the early adopters and the laggards within two, and way out there, at the very onset of a new technology, about three standard deviations from the norm, are the innovators. The groups are distinguished from each other by their characteristic response to a discontinuous innovation based on a new technology. Each group represents a unique psychographic profile, a combination of psychology and demographics that makes its marketing responses different from those of the other groups. Understanding each profile and its relationship to its neighbors is a critical component of high-tech marketing lore. Innovators pursue new technology products aggressively. They sometimes seek them out even before a formal marketing program has been launched. This is because technology is a central interest in their life, regardless of what function it is performing. At root, they are intrigued with any fundamental advance and often make a technology purchase simply for the pleasure of exploring the new device's properties. There are not very many innovators in any given market segment, but winning them over at the outset of a marketing campaign is key nonetheless, because their endorsement reassures the other players in the marketplace that the product does in fact work. Early adopters, like innovators, buy into new product concepts very early in their life cycle. But unlike innovators, they are not technologists. Rather, they are people who find it easy to imagine, understand, and appreciate the benefits of a new technology, and to relate these potential benefits to their other concerns. Whenever they find a strong match, early adopters are willing to base their buying decisions upon it. Because early adopters do not rely on well-established references in making these buying decisions, preferring instead to rely on their own intuition and vision, they are key to opening up any high-tech market segment. The early majority share some of the early adopters' ability to relate to technology, but ultimately they are driven by a strong sense of practicality. They know that many of these newfangled inventions end up as passing fads, so they are content to wait and see how other people are making out before they buy in themselves. They want to see well-established references before investing substantially. Because there are so many people in this segment, roughly one-third of the whole adoption life cycle, winning their business is key to any substantial profits and growth. The late majority shares all the concerns of the early majority, plus one major additional one. Whereas people in the early majority are comfortable with their ability to handle a technology product, should they finally decide to purchase it, members of the late majority are not. As a result, they wait until something has become an established standard, and even then, they want to see lots of support and tend to buy, therefore, from large, well-established companies. Like the early majority, this group comprises about one-third of the total buying population in any given segment. Courting its favor is highly profitable indeed, for while profit margins decrease as the products mature, so do the selling costs, and virtually all the R&D costs have been amortized. Finally, there are the laggards. These people simply don't want anything to do with new technology, for any of a variety of reasons, some personal and some economic. The only time they ever buy a technological product is when it is buried so deep inside another product. The Ways say that a microprocessor is designed into the braking system of a new car, that they don't even know it is there. Laggards are generally regarded as not worth pursuing on any other basis. To recap the logic of the technology adoption lifecycle, its underlying thesis is that technology is absorbed into any given community in stages corresponding to the psychological and social profiles of various segments within that community. This process can be thought of as a continuum with definable stages, each associated with a definable group, and each group making up a predictable portion of the whole. The high-tech marketing model. This profile is, in turn, the very foundation of the high-tech marketing model. That model says that the way to develop a high-tech market is to work the curve left to right, focusing first on the innovators, growing that market, then moving on to the early adopters, growing that market, and so on, to the early majority, late majority, and even to the laggards. In this effort, companies must use each captured group as a reference base for going on to market to the next group. Thus, the endorsement of innovators becomes an important tool for developing a credible pitch to the early adopters, that of the early adopters to the early majority, and so on. The idea is to keep this process moving smoothly, proceeding something like passing the baton in a relay race or imitating Tarzan swinging from vine to well-placed vine. It is important to maintain momentum in order to create a bandwagon effect that makes it natural for the next group to want to buy in. Too much of a delay, and the effect would be something like hanging from a motionless vine. Nowhere to go but down. Actually, going down is the graceful alternative. What happens more often is a desperate attempt to recreate momentum, typically through some highly visible form of promotion, which ends up making the company look like a Tarzan frantically jerking back and forth, trying to get a vine moving with no leverage. This typically leads the other animals in the jungle just to sit and wait for him to fall. There is an additional motive for maintaining momentum: to keep ahead of the next emerging technology. Portable electric typewriters were displaced by portable PCs, which in turn may someday be displaced by internet terminals. You need to take advantage of your day in the sun before the next day renders you obsolete. From this notion comes the idea of a window of opportunity. If momentum is lost, then we can be overtaken by a competitor, thereby losing the advantages exclusive to a technology leadership position. Specifically, the profit margin advantage during the middle to late stages, which is the primary source from which high-tech fortunes are made. This, in essence, is the high-tech marketing model, a vision of a smooth unfolding through all the stages of the technology adoption lifecycle. What is dazzling about this concept, particularly to those who own equity in a high-tech venture, is its promise of virtual monopoly over a major new market development. If you can get there first, catch the curve, and ride it up through the early majority segment, thereby establishing the de facto standard, you can get rich very quickly and own a highly profitable market for a very long time to come. Testimonials. Lotus 123 is a prime example of optimizing the high-tech marketing model. No one has ever argued that it was the best spreadsheet program ever written. Certainly, it wasn't the first. And many of the features people appreciate about it most were in fact derived directly from VisiCalc, its predecessor that ran on the Apple II. But Lotus 123 was the first spreadsheet for the IBM PC, and its designers were careful to tune its performance specifically for that platform. As a result, The innovators liked Lotus 1-2-3 because it was slick and fast. Then the early adopters liked it because it allowed them to do something they had never been able to do before, what later became popularized as what-if analysis. The early majority liked the spreadsheet because it fell into line with some very common business operations, like budgeting, sales forecasting, and project tracking. As more and more people began to use it, it became harder and harder to use anything else, including paper and pencil. So the late majority gradually fell into line. This was the tool people knew how to use. If you wanted to share a spreadsheet, it had to be in Lotus format. Thus, it became so entrenched that by the end of the 1980s, well over half the IBM PCs and PC compatibles with spreadsheets had Lotus 1-2-3, despite the fact that there were numerous competitors, many of which were, feature for feature, superior products. Astounding as this accomplishment is, many other companies have achieved a comparable status. This is what Oracle has achieved in the area of relational databases, Microsoft and PC operating systems, Hewlett-Packard in PC laser and inkjet printers, and IBM in mainframe computers. It is the position that Netscape is clinging to in internet browsers, Autodesk holds in PC CAD, ESRI has in GIS software, Cisco has in routers, and Intel has in microprocessors. Each of these companies holds market share in excess of 50% in its prime market. All of them have been able to establish strongholds in the early majority segment, if not beyond, and to look forward from that position to continued growth, wondrously strong profit margins, and increasingly preferred relationships as suppliers to their customers. To be sure, some like Oracle, and more dramatically, Netscape, have fallen on hard times. But even then, customers often bend over backwards to give market share leaders second and third chances, bringing cries of anguish from their competitors who would never be granted such grace. It should come as no surprise that the history of these flagship products conforms to the high-tech marketing model. In truth, the model was essentially derived from an abstraction of these histories. And so high-tech marketing, as we enter the next millennium, keeps before it the example of these companies and the abstraction of the high-tech marketing model, and marches confidently forward. Of course, if that were a sufficient formula for success, you would need to read no further. Illusion and disillusion. Cracks in the bell curve. It is now time to advise you that there are any number of us in Silicon Valley who are willing to testify that there is something wrong with the high-tech marketing model. We believe this to be true because we all own what once were meaningful equity stakes in corporations that either no longer exist or whose current valuation is so diluted that our stock, were there a market for it, which there is not, has lost all monetary significance. Although we all experienced our fates uniquely, much of our shared experience can be summarized by recasting the technology adoption lifecycle in the following way. As you can see from the figure on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, the components of the lifecycle are unchanged, but between any two psychographic groups has been introduced a gap. This symbolizes the dissociation between the two groups. That is, the difficulty any group will have in accepting a new product if it is presented in the same way as it was to the group to its immediate left. Each of these gaps represents an opportunity for marketing to lose momentum, to miss the transition to the next segment, thereby never to gain the promised land of profit margin leadership in the middle of the bell curve. The first crack. Two of the gaps in the high-tech marketing model are relatively minor, what one might call cracks in the bell curve. Yet even here, unwary ventures have slipped and fallen. The first is between the innovators and the early adopters, It is a gap that occurs when a hot technology product cannot be readily translated into a major new benefit, something